जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। गोपीचन बालब गिरवारे धारी, गोपीचन बालब गिरवारे धारी, यशोद नंदन व्रज जन रंजन, यशोद नंदन व्रज जन रंजन, यमुन तीर वन चारि, यमुन तीर वन चारि, जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी, जय ओम विष्णुपाद परमहंस परब्रजाचार्य सुतेर सद श्री श्रीमद् सुभाष ग्रेस एसी भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी महाराज श्री प्रभुपाद की जय। इसकन फाउंडर चार्य श्री प्रभुपाद की जय। नामाचार्य श्री हरिदास ठाकुर की जय। प्रेम से कहो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री द्वैत गिरधर श्रीवासी गौर भक्तवृंद की जय। All glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to Sri Sri Guru and Sri Garanga, Jaya Prabhupada, Namo Vishmaya, Krishna Samalesha, Madhavati, Yalanta, Swami, Pananda, Namo Vishmaya, Svam, Pranam, Vajan, Namo Vishmaya, Shri Vadi, Prashtacha, Deshitani. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 15. No, text 12. All right. Okay. Looks like the Brahma Samhita tune. We'll see if it works. Yate jasata bhagavan yudishu lapanayar. Bhishma pita sangirijo sramadhani jamme. Anye pichaham. Amunaiva kalevarena. Prapto Mahendra bhavane mahadasanardham. Yate jasata bhagavan yudishulapanir. Bhishma pita sagiri jostram. Adan nijang me. Anye pichaham amunaiva kalevarena. Prapto mahendra bhavane maharasanardham. Others?
Yeah.
Vaishnavis?
Yate jasata bhagavanya nishula kama.
Yet, by whose? Tejasa, by influence. Ata, at one time. Bhagavan, the personality of God, Lord Shiva. Yudhi, in the battle. Shulapani, one who has a trident in his hand. Bhishmapita, astonished. Sigirija, along with the daughter of the Himalaya Mountains. Astrum, weapon. Adat, awarded. Nijam, of his own. Me, unto me. Anyeyapi, definitely. Kalevarena, by the body. Did I miss a line? Okay, let's go back. Anyapi, so also others. Cha, and. Aham, myself. Amuna, by this. Eva, definitely. Kalevarena, by the body. Prapta, obtained. Maha Indra Bhavane, in the house of Indradev. Mahat, great. Asana Ardham, half elevated seat. They keep making the print smaller in these books. That was a joke. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. It was by His influence only that in a fight I was able to astonish the personality of God, Lord Shiva, and His wife, the daughter of Mount Himalaya. Thus He, Lord Shiva, became pleased with me and awarded me his own weapon. Other demigods also delivered their respective weapons to me, and in addition, I was able to reach the heavenly planets in this present body and was allowed a half-elevated seat. Purport. By the grace of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, all the demigods, including Lord Shiva, were pleased with Arjuna. The idea is that one who is favored by Lord Shiva or any other demigod may not necessarily be favored by the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna. Ravana was certainly a great devotee of Lord Shiva, but he could not be saved from the wrath of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Ramachandra. And there are many instances like that in the history of the Puranas. But here is an instance where we can see that Lord Shiva became pleased even in the fight with Arjuna. The devotees of the Supreme Lord know how to respect the demigods, but the devotees of the demigods sometimes foolishly think that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is no greater than the demigods. By such a conception, one becomes an offender and ultimately meets with the same end as Ravana and others. The instances described by Arjuna during his friendly dealings with Lord Sri Krishna are instructive for all who may be convinced by the lessons that one can achieve all favors simply by pleasing the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna, whereas the devotees or worshippers of the demigods may achieve only partial benefits, which are also perishable, just as the demigods themselves are. Another significance of the present verse is that Arjuna, by the grace of Lord Sri Krishna, was able to reach the heavenly planet even with the selfsame body and was honored by the heavenly demigod Indradev, being seated with him half-elevated. One can reach the heavenly planets by the pious acts recommended in the Shastra in the category of fruitive activities. And as stated in Bhagavad Gita 9.21, when the reactions of such pious acts are spent, the enjoyer is again degraded to this earthly planet. The moon is also on the level with the heavenly planets, And only persons who perform virtues only, performing sacrifice, given in charity, and undergoing severe austerities, can be allowed to enter into the heavenly planet after the duration of life on this body. Remember, Prabhupada is writing this soon after the supposed moon landing. Right? Arjuna was allowed to enter into the heavenly planets in the selfsame body simply by the grace of the Lord. Otherwise, it is not possible to do so. The present attempts to enter into the heavenly planets by the modern scientists will certainly prove futile, because such scientists are not on the level of Arjuna. They are ordinary human beings without any assets of sacrifice, charity, or austerities. The material body is influenced by the three modes of material nature, namely goodness, passion, and ignorance. The present population is more or less influenced by the mode of passion and ignorance, and the symptoms of such influence are exhibited in their becoming very lusty and greedy. Such degraded fellows can hardly approach the higher planetary systems. Above the heavenly planets, there are many other planets also, which only those who are influenced by goodness can reach. In heavenly and other planets within the universe, the inhabitants are all highly intelligent, many more times than human beings, and they are all pious in the higher and highest mode of goodness. They are all devotees of the Lord, and although their goodness is not unadulterated, still they are known as demigods, possessing the maximum amount of good qualities possible within the material world. Om Gyanatam Randasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksarun Mutamena Tasma Shri Gurve Namaha Vanchakalpa Trivyascha Kripasindubhavacha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Prabhupada. So I remember, I think it was in Potomac many, many years ago, the 70s, whatever. We used to get, of course, a lot of visitors to the Sunday feast, and they were mostly young Americans at that time. And so, you know, we'd always be trying to preach to and talk to the new visitors that would come. And I was speaking with one of our young, enthusiastic, but somewhat eccentric brahmacharis about preaching to new people. And he was saying, yeah, with these new people, you want to be really basic. He says, I usually just start out with telling about the demigods. So I was a little bit amused by that. I said, most Americans don't have any conception of demigods, except for maybe mythology or something. I said, maybe better start with you're not your body, your spirit, soul, you know, like that. So anyway, but the idea is that the position of the demigods is not really so easy to understand. For the devotees, this seems very simple and basic. It's true. This is like very basic, you know, Krishna Consciousness 101 to us. But for the rest of the world, not so much. Because we honor and respect the demigods as powerful devotees, very intelligent in the mode of goodness, as Srila Prabhupada is discussing in his purport. But we also know that the worship of them or obtaining their planets is not the goal of life. And Prabhupada has nicely balanced these two concepts in the purport, I thought. You know, he really covers sort of these both sides that we need to understand. So today I want to talk a little bit about the position of demigods and the difficulty in reaching them, and how the worship of Krishna is superior, and then how Arjuna's power, as was mentioned here, came not from the demigods but from Krishna, and how a devotee takes shelter and depends completely on Krishna for everything. Okay? So the demigods are the maintainers and controllers of the material universe. They're devotees of Krishna. They assist in universal governance. They have great intelligence. Lord Brahma has to have four heads to contain all that intelligence, that big brain power. And they have abilities beyond humans, right? They create things. They fly through the air. They travel on, you know, through the universe on flower airships and things we can't even imagine. And they're generally situated in high degree of the mode of goodness. Srila Prabhupada says they are all devotees of the Lord, and although their goodness is not unadulterated, still they are known as demigods, possessing the maximum amount of good qualities possible within the material world. Prabhupada doesn't spell it out here, but he kind of alludes to the fact that there's higher planetary systems and the highest planetary systems. So we have the heavenly planets, but above, you know, where Lord Indra is located, we're like a mid-range planet, and there's above us heavenly planets. At least we're not in the hellish planets right now. But then above the heavenly planets are this highest realm of Tapaloka, Jhanaloka, Maharaloka, which is very, very advanced. Mostly, these people are really basically devotees. You ever want a good description of these? Brihad Bhagavatamrita talks extensively about Gopalkumar's visits to these different realms. And like, I think it's Jhanaloka. They're devotees, but they're very mixed with jnana. They're all like meditating, they're jnanis, but they are devotees also. And he discusses those issues with them. So it's described that they're not necessarily all pure unadulterated devotees, which would mean being the Shuddhasattva, or the mode of pure goodness, which is above even the mode of the Sattva-guna mode of goodness. And so we do see examples throughout the Bhagavatam of how demigods can become influenced by the modes of nature. I think Indra is kind of our poster child, isn't he, for getting in trouble, for being influenced by the mode of passion, to the extent that he actually attacks the residents of Vrindavan during the Govardhan pastime, trying, you know, with his thunderbolts and everything else. Of course, Krishna has to completely defeat him. But he does, to his credit. He's very humbly submits to Krishna. He realizes his mistake, you know, kind of begs forgiveness. So these are very special people, despite the different issues that Indra seems to have. The fact that he's always getting Krishna's mercy and Krishna's darshan means it's a very special personality, right? So, in other words, and also some of it, like Lord Shiva, is in a sense not exactly in the same category. He Prabhupada says he's in his own category, his own tattva, you know, Shiva tattva. He's not exactly a jiva, ordinary living entity, and he's not exactly Vishnu tattva. He's somewhere in the middle. You know, he's in other words, he's very, very advanced, and he's considered the greatest Vaishnava. And Lord Brahma, of course, is the head of our sampradaya. You know, obviously a pure devotee, and he was, you know, and he was enlightened directly from Krishna in the very beginning of creation, and was empowered by Krishna with the ability to create. So obviously very, very special people. But the devotees know that the power of the demigods, however great they may be, and they can be very, very great, are not independent, but they are dependent upon Krishna. The Ishopanishad, remember that? We used to always read and chant the Ishopanishad. That's been about 50 years ago. But anyway, it was kind of, I forgot, I knew the first few verses, and then it gets very vague. But verse 4 is an aged ekam anasot jiviyo naitad deva apnavan purvamarshad tadavato nyan atyetatishtat tasmin napomat harishvadarati. Although fixed in his abode, the personality of Godhead is more swift than the mind and can overcome all others running. The powerful demigods cannot approach him, although in one place he controls those who supply the air and rain. He surpasses all in excellence. So in other words, Krishna is the controller of the universal controllers. The universal controllers who he has appointed to take care of the wind and the air and the rain and all of these things, he is their controller. So sometimes there is some confusion regarding the role of demigods, and we understand that. Clearly, and sometimes we might not think this is very relevant, you know, why do we talk about the demigods? Yet, it is an issue throughout the world. And in fact, almost all ancient and many modern religions accepted demigods. It's very, very common. Much of Europe, the Greeks, the Romans, remember Zeus was like counterpart of Indra, Apollo, like Surya, Athena, the goddess of learning, like Saraswati. They had Poseidon. You know, it's like Varuna, the god of the water. And then the Romans had their own versions, Jupiter, Minerva. They just had different names for the same ones. And then the Norse had Thor and Odin, and I don't remember too many of them. But very similar. I mean, Thor was throwing his thunderbolts down, just like Indra, right? So there's this understanding, you know, throughout much of the world about the demigods. In fact, the only exceptions really were Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, which tend to reject the demigods' existence and really stress a total monotheistic philosophy. So people are often bewildered by the worship of the demigods. They don't really see, they either don't see the distinction between the demigods and God, Krishna, or they reject the concept completely. So Why do people worship the demigods? Not so much in America, but particularly India, places, you know. Different reasons. And the Bhagavad Gita speaks a lot about the worship of the demigods. Not a lot, but I mean, it really covers the topic. One is this lack of knowledge. There's this philosophical merging of the role of Krishna and the demigods. Especially in academics, you'll see this in with the Hindu trinity, Brahma the creator, Vishnu the maintainer, Shiva the destroyer, like they're all the same. And there's a misunderstanding that Krishna and his incarnations come from Vishnu, and this Krishna is an incarnation just like all the other incarnations. And of course, we know that all those incarnations are listed in the Bhagavatam, the first canto, but after that incarnation comes a very famous statement of Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam, that Krishna is the source of all others. All of them are coming from Krishna. So, also, there's impersonalism. Impersonalists are Mayavadis, I guess you could say. Think, oh, you worship the demigods in the beginning, but ultimately, we want to become one, you know, with the Absolute. So therefore, they're thinking Krishna and the demigods are material manifestations, basically, that they're Maya. That's why where the term Mayavadi comes from. And, of course, Prabhupada said that the Mayavadis are great offenders. A little bit different than just an impersonalist, a Jnani, who's on the path of understanding God and is more focused on the all-pervading existence, but not really saying that Krishna and all his manifestations are just material. Then there's this idea of a general polytheism, worship of many gods at an equal level. And of course, Hinduism is often attributed to polytheistic religion, but we know, of course, that in its truest sense, Vaishnavism, it certainly is not. It's really monotheistic with an understanding of how Krishna delegates abilities and attributes to the demigods and others. But one of the main reasons for worshiping demigods is desire for material gain. Because pleasing the demigods gives rewards. And this isn't just some mythology. It does. It works. If you please the demigods, you do get some material gain. Prabhupada says, one can reach the heavenly planets by pious acts recommended in the Shastra in the category of fruitive activities. The moon is also on the level of the heavenly planets, and only persons who perform virtues only, performing sacrifice, giving charity, and undergoing severe austerities, can be allowed to enter in the heavenly planets after the duration life of this body. I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but you know, this idea that we didn't go to the moon that Prabhupada talked about is not just some strange thing that Hare Krishna cult believes in. It's actually, there's a lot of people who actually know that, understand that, even within government. And my brother, for instance, he had a lot of big positions in government. He worked for a senator, and then he was like chief of staff of the governor of Alaska and the state representative. You know, he knew a lot of people. And he told me, I don't know how we got talking about it one day, but he says, I know a lot of people in these, you know, sort of, you know, top positions, you know, in the space agency like that. And he said, we never went to the moon. He said, they all know that. I said, really? Yeah. He said, yeah, a lot of us know that it was just a concoction to get people excited about funding this space program. So, I mean, and he's not a devotee at all or anything, never read Prabhupada, you know. But, so, yeah, I mean, Prabhupada knew this. Because it's not possible. You get to the moon planet through performing the pious activities that qualify you to go there. Okay, so devotees understand that worship of Krishna is far superior to the worship of the demigods. And Bhagavad Gita makes a strong emphasis on this point in several verses. 7:20, Kamais Taishtaya Hritagyana. Those whose intelligence have been stolen by material desires surrender unto demigods and follow the particular rules and regulations of worship according to their natures. So, yeah, you can worship the demigods if your intelligence is stolen by material desires. Now, that's not really much of a selling point, is it? I mean, that's not very positive. And 7:23, men of small intelligence worship the demigods. Their fruits are limited and temporary. Those who worship the demigods go to the planets of the demigods, but my devotees ultimately reach my supreme planet. So the devotees are reaching for a higher destination. Krishna's own abode in Vaikuntha or Goloka in the spiritual world. So that's why the Bhagavad Gita is saying that you have less intelligence if you're worshiping the demigods, because the fruits are limited. You can't leave the material world. You're still here in the cycle of birth and death, and it is temporary. A person goes to a heavenly planet for a certain amount of time, uses up one's pious activity. After that's expended, Prabhupada explains, you fall back down and you start again in the material world, creating pious or impious karmic activity. So it's, in other words, it's rather futile. So an intelligent person understands better to get out of this material world, better to worship Krishna and be able to go back home, back to Godhead, to Krishna's abode. Bhagavad Gita 4.12 says, men in this world desire success and fruit of activities, and therefore they worship the demigods. Quickly, of course, men get results from fruit of work in this world. But, as Prabhupada points out in the purport, the demigods of this material world, as well as their worshippers, will vanish with the annihilation of the material world. The boons of the demigods are material and temporary. So, I mean, it may be a few hundred thousand years. Think demigods' lifespan, like Indra's, is something like 300,000 years. Something in that range, I think. But, you know, if you're on Indraloka and you're living 300,000 earth years, it still feels like a 100-year lifespan, pretty much. In other words, time is all relative in the material world. It's not absolute. It's relative to where you're situated. You know? So why bother? Why do that? Why aspire for such a thing? No. Because, as we know, Aparna Bhuvanaloka, from the highest planet to the lowest, all are places of misery wherein repeated birth and death take place. So that's the crux of it. You're still going to undergo repeated birth and death, have to take another body, go through it again, and it's just suffering for the living entity. So Arjuna, being very intelligent, took shelter of Krishna. He understood that Krishna was the source of everything for him, the source of all his success, all his strength, all his victories, everything. It's explained in this verse how he was honored by the demigods. He was actually practically on the level of demigods. He sat and gave a seat in heaven next to Indra. Actually, Indra was his father, wasn't it? Right? Indra was Arjuna's father? Okay, thank you. From us, all the Pandavas, of course, their fathers were demigods. So, you know, so they're practically on that level, you know. And it says that he defeated Lord Shiva in battle. And Lord Shiva became very pleased with him, and he gave him his weapon. And I think Agni also gave him a weapon. All these demigods gave Arjuna these fantastic weapons, so that during the battle of Kurukshetra, he obviously couldn't be defeated. And he had these tremendous weapons, and he was, of course, the greatest fighter and archer in the world. And all this was by the strength and the mercy of Lord Krishna. So that's what Arjuna is emphasizing. In fact, in this chapter, through several verses, Arjuna is recalling many incidents, and he goes through them systematically, things that had happened to him and the Pandavas, when time and again, in some danger, some calamity, he was protected. He and the Pandavas were protected from all dangers by Krishna. And so, because Krishna rescued them or helped them time and again. And so this is what he's remembering and what he's, you know, recalling and you know, pointing out, that everything was coming from Krishna. And then Prabhupada points out, conversely, that those who were taking shelter of only the demigods were often defeated, like Ravana and Hiranyakasipu, devotees of Lord Shiva. They got boons from Lord Shiva. Well, Hiranyakasipu got a boon from Lord Brahma, Ravana from Lord Shiva, and of course they were defeated by Krishna. I thought another interesting one was Banasura. Remember Banasura with 1,000 arms? Great, he was really a great demon, and I think he captured a lot of devotees or different princesses of the world. And so Krishna had to come to rescue them. So he's fighting Banasura, and of course he cuts off all of his arms and defeats him, maybe leaves two. But Banasura got all of his power from Lord Shiva. So Lord Shiva has to come to defend or fight with his devotee. So Lord Shiva also fights with Krishna. Particularly, he releases his Shivajvar, his great weapon, and of course, Krishna easily defeats that. You know, so he defeats Banasura, he defeats Lord Shiva, and he gives protection to his devotees. Of course, now why would Lord Shiva, who's the greatest Vaishnava, be fighting with Krishna? Well, it's actually explained by the Acharyas for two reasons. One, just like Jaya and Vijaya came to the material world, for different reasons, mainly because, you know, sometimes Krishna likes a good fight. You know, it's part of his lila. You know, it's one of his rasas, his chivalry rasa. And so he wants a worthy opponent. Ravana and Hiranyakasipu, these were worthy opponents. You know, they defeated all the other demigods. Lord Shiva, who could be more powerful than Lord Shiva? So Lord Shiva wanted to give him a good fight. And secondly, it's described Lord Shiva wanted to show everyone that Krishna was supreme. Supreme even over him, that he could not defeat Krishna. He wanted people to know that. Because he's the greatest Vaishnava. That means he worships Krishna. He's Krishna's devotee, and he wants Krishna glorified. So by engaging in that battle, he helped to glorify Krishna. And of course, it also demonstrated again in all these situations how when the devotee takes shelter of Krishna's protection, then Krishna will give them that. There's some very nice prayers by the personified Vedas in chapter 87, 10th canto. Some of them are a little philosophically complex. But this one, text 27, is a little easy, fairly easy to understand. And in the first line is this Sanskrit phrase that Krishna is Akila Sattva Niketataya. Akila Sattva Niketataya means that he's the shelter of all created entities. So the personified Vedas, who of course are great devotees, they were such great devotees that they actually wanted to enter Vraja Leela. And the personified Vedas were given bodies as gopis in the next lifetime in Vrindavan. So, pretty cool. Anyway, so these great devotees are saying that Krishna is the shelter of all created entities. It's described in that verse that there's two meanings. There's the philosophical truth of Krishna's reality, that everything is resting on him. He's the shelter. Sometimes the word ashraya is also used like that. He's the shelter. Everything rests on him. Everything is dependent upon him. Everything is coming from him. But it says there's a deeper meaning that Krishna is the true shelter of devotees. And the purport quotes Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. It says that he points out yet another more confidential meaning of Akila Sattva Niketa, that the Supreme Lord's personal abodes are in no way Kila, or imperfect, therefore Akila, and so they are called Vaikuntha, the realms free of anxiety and restriction. Vaishnavas, whose devotional service to the Lord is kindly accepted, are so sure of his protection that they no longer fear death, which becomes for them just another easy step on the way back to their eternal home. So, this is what devotees understand, that Krishna gives this protection. And so therefore they feel free even from death and free from all anxiety. Of course, Vaikuntha means place with no anxiety. So devotees want to go back to Vaikuntha, place with no anxiety. And simply by taking shelter of Krishna, that's achieved. We take shelter and protection, not just Krishna, some abstract, you know, supreme being, but in a loving relationship with Krishna. So that's very important understanding in Krishna consciousness, that it's a relationship of love and service, not simply an impersonal type of relationship or relationship where, yes, Krishna is this supreme figure and I have to worship him somehow. And Prabhupada gives an example often of the a cat with a kitten in their mouth or the mouse in their mouth and their teeth. So for the kitten, this is the shelter of their parent. This is my mother. For the mouse, Prabhupada says, certain death. So that's the difference. Krishna is seen as death, the materialist, time I am, destroyer of the worlds. But it's the shelter, the loving parent to the devotees, giving protection. So Arjuna's final instructions in the Bhagavad Gita in the 18th chapter were all about taking shelter of Krishna. Well, they cover a lot of things. But that was sort of the key. 1856 and 57, though engaged in all kinds of activities, my pure devotee, under my protection, reaches the eternal and imperishable abode by my grace. 57, and all activities just depend upon me and work always under my protection. In such devotional service, be fully conscious of me. So Krishna is advising Arjuna how to fully engage in devotional service, you know, by accepting his protection and always serving me. And actually now in the Bhagavatam, which is, this part is of course spoken after the battle of Kurukshetra, after the Bhagavad Gita was spoken, Arjuna is demonstrating this, which is exactly what he did, taking Krishna's words and taking shelter of Krishna. And he cites all the ways that Krishna had given protection. And then, of course, the final instruction, 1866, abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. I shall deliver you from all sinful reaction. Do not fear. So the concept here is that through devotion and surrender to God, he gives protection to the devotees, but he also purifies and removes reaction. So, in other words, it's both material and spiritual protection. It's not just like, oh, I'm in danger, God save me. It's more, much more than that. It's Krishna is delivering us. He's purifying us. He's helping us to come back to him. He's helping us to learn and to know how to love him. And so our hearts open, and that spiritual understanding grows and grows through the process of worship of Krishna, through our bhakti. So, of course, we do seek protection. Everyone needs to seek protection from God. I was thinking about how the world is becoming increasingly dangerous, even a frightening place. And it seems like sometimes we are less able to predict and control negative events. Everything from COVID. Who would have thought 2 years ago that there would be this worldwide epidemic? You know, or we can just barely predict hurricanes. We certainly can't control them. They're going to come and do what they're going to do. And that's just, and that's not even what man does. I mean, that's just the, adivotic and adidaivic miseries. I mean, the adidaivic miseries. But the adivotic miseries, ones caused by other living entities. For instance, the last 3,420 years of recorded history, there's only been 268, about 8% of the time, without a major war. Constantly battle. There's been like, since recorded time, over 14,000 wars. You know, is it surprising? No. Age of quarrel and hypocrisy, Kali Yuga. And even recently, we see these changes. I mean, those of us who are a little bit older, in the last 50, 60, 70 years, seen so many changes of things that become more dangerous and distressing. I was thinking, I think about these things, being in security, is about active shooters events in the United States. We'd never heard of these until Columbine 21 years ago in Colorado. And since that time, in the last 20 years, there's been 333 active shooter incidents. Over 1,000 people killed, 1,800 wounded. These are FBI statistics. You all know how I love statistics. 62 of those incidents have been in schools. Can you imagine? Would we've ever thought we had to worry about our children having somebody come in and start shooting children? I mean, some are, of course, in higher education, too. Of course, this was, at first, was very, very shocking. Now we're almost numb to it. You know, in the last month, there were at least three major shooter incidents. Two in Colorado, another one in Indiana. I mean, you know, just these, when I'm talking about these statistics, this isn't like gang shootings or somebody of domestic quarrel. This is only those random killings of unknown people, unrelated people, just for whatever reason. So fear is part of modern life. It's one of the animal propensities, fearing or defending. When I was a child, it was nuclear attacks. I don't know if anyone's old enough to remember those. We had to do drills, you know, in case of a nuclear holocaust. So we'd get under our desks. You know, we learned how to do that. They made great desks back in those days. You know, I guess those desks were going to protect us against nuclear blasts, fallout, anything. Kumar. So, anyway, I guess they figured it's better than nothing. Get under the desk, at least. Anyway, as I said, it's part of material. Of course, today, the children are doing active shooter drills. It's mandated by Florida government like that. And our schools do these. And it's not crazy. I mean, there's a reason for it. So this degradation, of course, was predicted 5,000 years ago by the Srimad Bhagavatam about Kali Yuga, that fighting and quarrel is going to be the nature of people, and religious qualities have become more and more scarce, but the ungodly qualities and ungodly people become more prominent. So what to do? Well, first of all, use your intelligence. You don't stand out in the busy roads saying, Krishna, protect me, you know. Srila Prabhupada said, he says, we don't say, tiger, come and eat me, because Krishna will protect. No, he says, you know, you use your good common sense and intelligence, that if you're a surrendered devotee, Krishna is guiding your intelligence through the super soul. So rely on your good intelligence, you know, to be sensible, you know, to take care of yourself and take care of others. But we know, we do our best, we use our intelligence, that only Krishna can ultimately protect ourselves. And Prabhupada would say, sometimes a person gets the absolute very best medical care and they die. And sometimes other people should die and they miraculously recover. So we can't control everything. But we have the conviction that Krishna will give us protection. That's one of the qualities, one of the symptoms, the six divisions of surrender. That's Nahari Bhakta Balas quoted in Majalila 22-100. So the devotee feels under the personal protection and guidance of Krishna. In the purport to that verse, Majalila 22-100, Prabhupada says, situated in everyone's heart, Krishna deals differently according to the living entity's position. The living entity's position is to be under the protection of the illusory energy or under Krishna's personal protection. When a living entity is fully surrendered, he is under the direct protection of Krishna, and Krishna gives him all intelligence by which he can advance in spiritual realization. So, of course, when one is spiritually realized, when one advances in spiritual realization by the mercy of Krishna, they understand the soul is different from the body that we are encaged in. And that realization brings about more fearlessness. Right? Obviously, if you know you're not the body, at least you have some deeper understanding and realization about that, you're going to be less fearful all the time about the body and depending more upon Krishna, and Krishna simply give you the intelligence. Because that fear of death particularly comes from false ego, identification with the body. Not that it's difficult. In fact, our acharyas say that that connection, that identification is very, very strong. So that even for an advanced devotee, one is naturally in a time of fear or a time of danger, you're naturally going to try to protect your body. In other words, that's normal. That's natural. But we try to do that, but at the same time, we try to always remember Krishna and get his protection. Well, another factor is that by being put in distress, Krishna increases the devotee's love. So why did the Pandavas have all these distresses and dangers? Why do we sometimes feel distress and danger? One of the reasons is to increase our love. Prabhupada explains, when a devotee is in danger, he thinks, now Krishna has appeared before me as danger. God is never dangerous to the devotee. And the devotee is never afraid of dangers because he is confident the danger is but another feature of God. Why should I be afraid? The devotee thinks, I am a surrender to him. That's obviously a very advanced devotee. Therefore, Kunti Dev says, Vipada Santu, let all those calamities happen again and again. Because she knows how to remember Krishna at times of danger. She's welcoming danger. My dear Lord, she says, I welcome danger because when dangers come, I can remember you. Now, I don't think most of us are going to just welcome danger. At least I'm not that advanced. But certainly, if we do encounter danger, encounter distress, difficult situations, we should at least try to remember Krishna. Because one who knows Krishna has spiritual fearlessness and strength. And that's the really most important, that Krishna gives spiritual protection to the devotees. Now, what does that mean? That means that we're not going to lose our Krishna consciousness. We're not going to, you know, he says, Krishna protects that. Whatever stage we reach at this point, even this lifetime, if we don't make it, we take up at that point. Our Krishna consciousness, that credit is never lost. And Krishna is always trying to work to help us to advance in spiritual life. That's Krishna's real protection. Although he also gives material protection at times. So how do we see Krishna's protection? It can come in many different ways, and we do not always see it. Sometimes our karma is simply mitigated. Prabhupada said, the knife that cuts our hand in the kitchen was meant to slit our throat. And, you know, rather dramatic example, you know, but it gets the point across. In other words, we might have been meant to be killed, and instead we suffer some, you know, little cut or some very small injury. So, first of all, our reactions and karma is so much mitigated by Krishna, by becoming devotees. And also, God can work directly through his spiritual energy. He can work through his material energy, works through his devotees in any way. Krishna can do whatever he wants. But we often see Krishna's protecting, sometimes in ways that we never anticipated. Or we see something that seemed very negative may turn out to be positive in terms of our spiritual life and our spiritual advancement, which is what Krishna is really trying to help us to attain. So the devotee takes shelter, understanding we are under the protection of Krishna, and accept everything as his mercy. And of course, the best way of attaining that mercy, of taking shelter, is through the holy name. If nothing else, if it's hard to remember Krishna or hard to remember the philosophy, just chant Hare Krishna. Chant the holy names of the Lord, and then protection will be there. Okay. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Any questions, comments, discussion? Yes. Got a graduate.
They say that the Pandavas, they had to suffer so much. So this suffering, you know, because they're such great devotees, you know, what is it that they transcend the suffering, or is it that it's very small, or is it that it doesn't affect them? You know, they're such great devotees, that, you know, like we suffer physical pain, you know, like anxiety or something in our mind, or how does it, if they're so great devotees that, like, actually it's Krishna Lila, really.
Yeah.
So that, what is the,
yeah, that's
the quality actually, of that suffering?
I understand, yeah, it's a great question, and I don't know that I have the exact answer, but my understanding is that it's not experienced to the same extent, and Prabhupada discussed that about his own situation in his last, you know, few months, his last year, when he was actually in great pain, and when he was, you know, preparing to leave his body. And the Prabhupada said once, he said, an ordinary person with this pain would be screaming aloud. So what does that mean? Does it mean he didn't feel the pain? I don't think that a great devotee does. It's not that there's no pain exactly, but it's experienced in a different way. Because there's such a high level of Krishna consciousness, of understanding, in other words, there is some ability to, as you said, transcend that. In other words, to transcend the level of the material body and be on the spiritual platform. But I think it's maybe sentimental to think, well, pure devotee doesn't feel any pain. You know, yeah, I mean, it's there. And then, of course, also is the idea that the distress and things is seen as an opportunity to remember Krishna, and that's what Queen Kunti was expressing. She welcomed calamities, not because she liked calamities or she's, you know, she was enjoying that, but it helped, but because it was an opportunity to remember Krishna and surrender to Krishna. So sometimes it's just, yeah, it's just an opportunity to surrender more to Krishna.
There's a couple of online
okay.
Comments and questions. First one is from Stita de Muni Prabhu. We should be careful about taking into account everything Prabhupada said about an issue like moon landings.
Like what?
These moon landings.
Oh. Okay.
No doubt the astronauts did not experience the realm of Chandraloka. Perhaps, similarly, a materialist with ordinary senses may not experience the spirituality of visiting Vrindavan. In any event, Prabhupada said many things about this with concern for time and place. That's kind of a comment question.
Okay.
And then Mahavishnu Priya Mataji said, statistics put persons in India killed by COVID between 2 and 4 million. Is Krishna trying to balance nature in protection of Mother Earth or for some other reason?
Well, our regular Mahavishnu Priya, Mataji, and once again, has one of her stumping questions for me. Why did Krishna bring about, let COVID bring about? I would say it's more or less, it's more or less a material reaction. You know, it's within the realm of, Mother Earth, withholds when there's not proper worship, when there's not proper sacrifice, worship of Krishna, and, other things happen, when things are going in the wrong direction. And because there's so much sinful activity on the planet Earth, then you're going to get things like this. You're going to get disease. You're going to get, all sorts of anomalies, really. I mean, just like the climate is going crazy now. I mean, wildfires and this and that. I mean, is Krishna like planning all that out? Well, Krishna's ultimately behind everything. So, yeah, but on the other hand, Krishna sort of delegates this to his agents, to the demigods. They're all in charge of this, and the different reactions are meted out in different ways. So, yeah, I don't know if there's a grand plan. And, of course, there's individuals, too, involved. We've had many devotees pass away from COVID. So, I don't think they're part of just the general reaction to sinful activity. There may have been some special purpose or reason or whatever for that with Krishna. So I think these things are complicated, which is a good way of me saying I don't really know.
There's a couple more questions if you have time.
Okay.
One from Stita Dimuni. When considering anxieties, how does fear of active school shooters today compare with fear of complete nuclear annihilation at the height of the Cold War? Is one an improvement over the other?
No. Probably not. Complete annihilation was... Whether that we were really at that point or not, I don't know, but we certainly feared it. We certainly often felt it growing up in the 50s and 60s. At least that was the general mood. So I guess what's different is that seemed very abstract. I've heard like someone who flies an airplane and drops bombs in the military sometimes will say, I can do that, I'm just up there, I'm driving, but it'd be very hard for them. They feel very different if they're face-to-face with the person they killed, right? I mean, and I guess what is so alarming about these active shooter things is that they're so random, they're so without purpose, without meaning. Of course, sometimes terrorists are sometimes involved, so sometimes there is a political purpose behind, but most of them are not. Most of them are basically people with grievances who are mentally ill a little bit or whatever, and sometimes they're suicidal. At least a third of them kill themselves or let themselves get killed. So I think that's what makes it a little different somehow. It's not abstract. It's like that people are actually doing this, looking face to face at people. And at least that's what disturbs me, almost more than nuclear bombs, although that should be more disturbing. Right. Anyway, yeah, that's Kali Yuga, material world. Interesting question. Okay. One more?
Yeah,
okay, and then...
They're coming in now. Oh.
Well, you want to do that one, then we'll get you there.
Okay. From Manjari Reddy, I understand from what you have explained that Krishna is trying to strengthen our love and devotion for him when these calamities come. However, when struggling with mental illness, it is not always easy to remember this. Is there any advice that you can offer?
It's not always easy to remember Krishna when these things happen, when they occur, is what they're saying.
Or when you have mental illness.
If you have what?
Mental illness.
If you have mental illness, yeah. That's a real problem. But people in any situation, even physical or mental situations, can chant Hare Krishna and remember Krishna. We had, back in 50 years ago, we had a lot of people come to the temple. Radhagaraj, wouldn't you say a lot of them were a little bit on the mentally ill side? Some of our people who had joined back in the 70s, and we had a few, right? And not us, you and I, we were pretty normal. But but I mean, I know there's some stories. As we have one devotee who's now passed away, who became a great Sanskrit scholar, who apparently when he came to Boston Temple, he was like, you know, completely out there. But by chanting Hare Krishna, by the process, you know, it works. And people can at least take shelter of Krishna. And but it is difficult sometimes. It's not that it's always easy, and I guess that's why we talk about it a lot. If it were easy, it wouldn't be a subject of conversation or questions. No, it can be difficult, but we have to try to do it. We have to try to remember Krishna and at least chant Hare Krishna, hear the philosophy, and that will help us remember Krishna in times of danger. And sometimes in times of danger, Krishna just protects us anyway. So we need to develop that faith. Okay, Sudhi.
Thank you. I saw this press conference with President Obama. I don't know if he was president at that time or not. It was a few years ago. Mm. And he was talking about the space program. And he was saying that we're looking to discover technology to leave Earth's lower orbit, Earth's orbit, which is like lower space. Mm. And then somebody naturally brought up the question, like, well, didn't we go to space, into space, you know, in 1969? And his answer was, we did go into space, but we don't have that technology anymore. We lost it. So that was his answer.
Interesting.
So,
in other words, he was kind of putting his foot in his mouth and saying something he shouldn't have said, and he had to kind of back out of it. Or something like that, I don't know. Yeah, I don't think you lose technology like that. Mysteriously, it disappears, you know. You know. But anyway, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that. Okay, we should end class, I think. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.